Another Glenn and Helen podcast. This is our 12th podcast, which I guess constitutes a season if you're Ricky Gervais. Unlike Ricky Gervais, though, we don't plan to start charging you 99 cents an episode.
I thought you were talking before about charging $100 an episode, Glenn.
Yeah, that's what I figured. We're getting about 100,000 downloads an episode here, and 100,000 downloads at $100 each. We'll be retiring and doing these shows from our private castle in the Caribbean.
Seriously, I think we'll just take our payment and attention.
Oh,
we
yeah,
appreciate,
like we always do.
Yeah, we really appreciate all our readers and listeners and people who have emailed us to comment on the podcast and helped us basically put together a better show.
Absolutely. And this episode has a lot of blogospheric input. We're going to be talking to some people about cardiology and answering readers' questions on that. And then we're going to be talking about the port security issue.
We're talking to Laurie Anderson today, a nurse practitioner at WebMD who blogs on heart disease. We'll also be talking to Dr. Wes Fisher, an electrophysiologist and cardiologist, about prevention and treatment of heart problems.
And we're going to have Stuart Baker, the Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security for Policy, talking about the Dubai ports issue. And he's also going to give us the official reaction to some port security suggestions from Frank J. Fleming. So stay tuned for an action-packed show.
Heart disease affects an estimated 62 million Americans more than any other illness. We're talking today about heart health with Dr. Wes Fisher, a board-certified electrophysiologist, cardiologist, and internist in the Chicago metro area who runs the MedTees.com site. We're also talking with Laurie Anderson, a nurse practitioner who blogs at WebMD. She shares information and advice on heart disease, its symptoms, treatments, and prevention. We have them both on the phone to answer our questions and yours regarding heart problems.
I'll start with the first question. Dr. Wes, what is an electrophysiologist and who needs to see you?
Electrophysiologists can be thought of as an electrician for the heart. Now, what I mean by that is that people who have heart rhythm abnormalities, either the heart moving too quickly, too slowly, or erratically, are people that we tend to be referred. And we have lots of therapies available that can help control heart rhythm abnormalities. Also make recommendations regarding medical as well as surgical treatments.
What are the signs of a heart attack or other problems for men, Dr. Wes?
Well, typically for men, the classic symptoms are those of exertional chest discomfort of some type. And so when people are working hard, they tend to develop problems with shortness of breath, tightness in their jaw or chest area. Usually it tends to be centrally located, but sometimes shoulder discomfort or left arm discomfort can occur, and on rare occasions, pain in the back can actually occur as well. And I've even seen a few people that after they eat, they actually start burping because they are affecting the bottom wall of their heart, which is near the stomach, when this occurs. So
wow. So how do you tell the difference between indigestion and a heart attack?
Well, that's one of the big problems a lot of people have, but the key issue is that typically it's exertional in nature, so that when people, they have worsened symptoms when they exercise rather than when they're at rest. And that's one of the key things that we look for when we're trying to evaluate these symptoms in men.
Okay. And then, Laurie, for you, what are the signs of a heart attack for women? Are they different?
They can be different. It's interesting, some of the things cross over, as Dr. Wes is saying, that some women have typical chest pain or back pain symptoms. Excuse me, but more interestingly to me, many women don't have very typical signs. And the red flag for me will be a woman who comes in and says, I can't do the things that I used to do. I can't get through my day without being totally exhausted or maybe short of breath. So climbing stairs, vacuuming the house, going to a job, and even just sitting at the desk under pressure of, I've got a lot to do, anything that puts them under physiologic or mental stress or strain may make them feel totally wiped out when a few weeks ago it was no sweat. It was their daily routine.
And we have a question, Laurie, for you about younger women since we're on this topic. I've gotten a lot of questions. For the listeners out there, when I was 37, I had a heart attack. And then a year ago, I got an implantable defibrillator. So I have a lot of interest in heart disease, obviously. But I get a lot of questions from young women. And here's one from one of our readers. She says, you know, say you're between 25 and 35, what can you do to protect your heart if you're a woman? And what, if anything, should I be doing to make sure that any potential problems are diagnosed and treated early?
Well, I think you look at risk factors with whoever is working with you to take care of your health. So what's your family history like? What are your personal risk factors? Are you overweight? Are you a smoker? Do you have high blood pressure, high blood sugar? All of those risk factors that you can have some ability to change. Do you exercise, which is an independent risk factor? People can be otherwise healthy but sedentary and have an increased risk of heart disease. So an open dialogue with somebody who's helping you to plan for your future about how you take care of yourself is very important. Young women, one of the things that's really interested me out of the WISE study is that they're starting to identify that even 18-year-olds have to be looked at, that there's microvascular disease in women that we can't identify by the typical modalities that we look at when we stress test somebody or when we do a cardiac cath. Those women often don't have those big blockages that show up under those testing techniques. And we don't really know why they have that microvascular disease and whether it's different, because some of the early studies seem to look, early information seems to look like it doesn't really have to do with typical things like smoking and elevated cholesterol. So I think even young women have to have a high index of suspicion and be evaluated for chest pain. And as you experienced, that frequently doesn't happen.
Tell us what the WISE study is. There's a lot of listeners out there don't understand or know what that would be.
The WISE study is the study called Women's Ischemia Syndrome Evaluation. It's part of an NIH study that has a number of goals, one of which is developing diagnostic tools that are appropriate for evaluating chest pain in women.
Okay.
Another goal of the study is that they want to know if women have symptoms of decreased coronary blood flow but don't have typical appearing blockages, do they have poorer long-term prognosis? And they're also looking at the influence of our reproductive hormones on women's heart health.
Yeah, I think those are really important. I mean, I think that our hormones for women seem to play some part, estrogen or progesterone or something, but obviously doctors don't know a whole lot about that.
WISE has one of the first pieces of information coming out of that, the first round of that trial, was that there may be some evidence that low estrogen levels are a problem in premenopausal women. And they think that because, in general, overall, young women don't have blockages. But when they do, they tend to have a lot of them, and they have higher mortality.
This is a question for both of you. Do you think birth control pills could contribute to a heart attack in women?
I don't think so, but I don't know that we know. What they're looking at is low levels as opposed to physiologic levels or maintaining physiologic levels.
We do know that estrogen treatment in men was not protective, interestingly enough. So it's much more than just the effects of a hormone in men. They basically had no additional protective effects in studies that looked at the use of estrogen to try and prevent heart attack. So certainly estrogen alone is not the only answer here, and it ends up being one of the real conundrums that we're left with. We do know that women who smoke and use birth control pills are at very high risk of developing blood clots, and that should really be discouraged in the general population, if at all possible.
Right. Well, Dr. West, what do you, I know on you have a blog, drwest.blogspot.com, and I know you've talked a little bit about federal funding, and that's one of the concerns I have, because while I really press and really am concerned about women's heart health, we want to make sure that men get equal access. How do you think that we can make sure that both men and women have equal access to federal funding for heart disease research?
Well, I think the NIH actually does a pretty good job in their bidding process. It is very much a kind of independent reviewer that occurs and an expert in the field. Historically, medicine has been predominantly controlled by men in the past. However, as the medical schools are graduating increasing numbers of women in the healthcare community, and I think that soon we're going to start to see a shift of more and more women reviewers for these trials. I think it's important that we, you know, just keep things balanced. But I do think that there are enough really fascinating studies going on right now with really good institutions, and the process of bidding for these is such that it really helps equalize somewhat some of the disparities between studies for men and women. What we do know is that a lot for heart disease in particular, most of the studies that were first done, because they were performed in a VA population, which was mostly men, unfortunately did not develop tests to detect heart disease very well for women. And I think that now with the WISE study and many of the other appreciations of basically the simple anatomic differences between men and women, particularly in the chest area, our imaging is often, particularly when we use radioactive substances to image how the heart works, the breast attenuation that occurs causes artifacts, and we need to see if we can figure out a better way. One of those better ways has actually become the 64-slice CT scan now, which are very high-resolution CAT scans, not just the heart scans that people hear about out in the doc-in-the-box type places.
Yeah, are those any good? We've got readers writing in, or, you know, I hear about these scans. Are they any good?
Yeah.
Are they a waste of time?
Well, I think what they do is detect calcium, but they can't really look at how blocked the arteries themselves are. And the new 64-slice high-resolution CAT scans, which are now beginning to come on the scene in more and more centers, but typically are available at very large heart centers, are really providing the actual ability to look at the blood vessel itself. There still are limitations because the scans really look at the amount of calcium in the blood vessel, but can actually look at the thickness of the blood vessel and how contrast injected through those blood vessels can appear. A scan that occurs on the heart only takes 8 seconds with these newer CT scans, and because it's gated to a regular heart rhythm, it gives unbelievably beautiful pictures of the blood vessels of the heart, and in some circumstances can actually help make a diagnosis where there's some question without in a non-invasive way in the patient who comes in with chest pain in the emergency room. And its role in women really is very much an unknown as well at this point.
So can people get these for preventative reasons? Say you're just worried, you just think, oh, I have a history of heart trouble in my family or something.
Not yet.
Okay.
And I think unless you want to shell out an awful lot of money, right now it's not being reimbursed by Medicare because the actual tests and studies that have been used to compare it to invasive coronary angiography or the pictures of the blood vessels that we do when we do a heart catheterization have yet to really had a prospective randomized trial showing one as being superior over the other. But I think with the desire of the general population to have a test that is non-invasive and that does not involve a catheter inside the heart, I think that there will be a push to try and improve the resolution and the diagnostic capabilities of that study, and hopefully it'll become something that people might be able to get in the future.
Lori, let me ask sort of a preventive question that kind of goes with this. There's been a lot of publicity about various over-the-counter preparations like coenzyme Q10, folic acid to reduce homocysteine, omega-3s and fish oils and stuff. What's the research on that in terms of its benefits, if any?
Well, CQ10 has some literature. Actually, Dr. West may want to speak to this because it's kind of in his arena, and that is that there seems to be some evidence that at least in making people feel better, CQ10 is helpful in patients with heart failure. Some of the other things I don't think that we really know yet. Certainly fish oils are being promoted for their benefits in cholesterol lowering, and that's true. It is very helpful. I actually went to a lecture with Dr. Bill Castelli, a Framingham study, a few months ago, and he was very, very big proponent of fish oils along with statins. Seems like there's a lot of evidence that not only does it lower total cholesterol, but it gives you better ratios and is very effective at lowering triglycerides, particularly in diabetic patients. I just blogged actually on a very interesting study that's coming out of the University of Texas where they isolated fat cells and put them under stress and showed that they produced C-reactive protein. And then they put those cells, exposed those cells to statins, aspirin, and one of the diabetic drugs, one of the glitazones, and all of those things were effective at reducing the output of CRP from the fat cells. So it was interesting that they both identified that fat cells have a specific role in producing CRP, which has some interesting implications for people who are overweight, but also that they know now that the things that we're taking, we're giving patients, are helpful at reducing CRP levels. What we don't know yet is what's the point of CRP other than it's an inflammatory marker? Does it actually have some kind of proactive role in there or not? They're working on a follow-up study that seems to indicate that women, overweight women who actually have a fairly high CRP level tend to have fairly low heart disease rates, and then especially in younger women, and then gentlemen, particularly in the African-American race, have very high CRP levels have very low CRP levels that don't seem to support the fact that they have very high cardiovascular disease rates. So we don't know what CRP is going to, how it's going to play out yet, and that some of the supplements seem to be pointing at, well, take this to lower your CRP level. Does it help to reduce inflammation? Sure. And does it have a good role? Probably. But I don't know that we have all the answers yet about those things.
Say you're a person, say, with a very high CRP level. How aggressively should you treat that CRP?
Well, I think, again, it's a marker that tells us about inflammation. And it doesn't hurt to get that number down. But I think you have to not look at that in exclusion of all of the other risk factors that you have for cardiovascular disease. I don't even test CRP levels usually except when I have somebody who has no other reason. And how frequent is it that a patient has no other reason to have heart disease? You know, there's usually lots of other very easily identified risk factors that I can treat, I can address with the individual. If I have a young person with no other risk factors evident, I might look at CRP levels and say, well, gee, this is high, and we certainly should look at fish oils and anti-inflammatories and get that number down, because it's the one thing we can point our finger at and say, well, there's a problem here. But that's a very infrequent person.
Okay. Dr. West, how our readers are really concerned about cholesterol, and they're asking us, is it worth trying to meet these arbitrary guidelines? For example, keep your LDL under 100 or your cholesterol under 150. I mean, these guidelines are extremely low.
Right.
Would you try to meet those if you were, say, a normal person? Or what about someone like me with heart disease?
Well, I think there's a couple things that we're finding out about cholesterol that have been very interesting. For every 1% drop in an LDL level, there's about a corresponding 1% drop in heart disease risk. And so there is basically what they call a linear relationship. To the lower the LDL, lower the risk of recurrent heart attack and readmission after a heart attack that'll occur. And so speaking to that as well, we're also finding that the HDL, the high-density lipoprotein factor, which is sometimes called the good cholesterol, raising that may even have more effect than actually lowering LDL in many people. The problem is that we just don't have any real good drugs quite yet that people can tolerate that will raise HDL. We have good drugs that will lower LDL in very large quantities. The problem is we don't have any real good drugs to raise HDL yet, with the exception of niacin. But unfortunately, many people who take niacin find that they can get flushing and kind of hot flashes with that drug and really may not be able to tolerate it. So exercise does definitely increase HDL, which is the good cholesterol, and can also greatly reduce the risk for heart disease. So I would strongly, I don't care, when we have someone that I see, it doesn't matter where their cholesterol is. If they've had a heart attack, I think their LDL needs to be lower and their HDL needs to be higher any way we can do it.
Mm. Say that the person is doing intense cardiovascular exercise. Now, there's some people that wrote in on our blogs and they said, you know, I do so much exercise and it's killing me. You know, these are sweat dripping workouts. I'm 49 years old. Do I need to do this much exercise? Is there some reasonable amount of exercise, some moderate amount a person can get by with?
I think what the real message here needs to be that there has to be, people have to watch their ideal body weight. I think the metabolic syndrome and really needs to be looked at more carefully, which is people who are markedly overweight for their age and size. Those people are probably going to have more trouble with coronary disease. But we've all heard about the marathon runner who collapses from a heart attack and sudden death. But those may not be related to occlusive blockages in the artery. It's important to realize that a lot of people also have weakened heart muscles from viruses and from other causes that we don't necessarily always understand. And one of the things that I see often are people who die suddenly and very unexpectedly, and often it's because they've developed a weakened heart muscle from inflammation of the muscle itself called myocarditis. And myocarditis can be caused by viruses or drugs, particularly some chemotherapeutic agents can cause that. And we now know that automatic defibrillators in people who have a heart muscle function less than 35%, we call it an ejection fraction, that is the amount of blood ejected from the heart with each heartbeat. When that number is under 35%, people can live longer if they have a automatic defibrillator, irrespective of why they have that device or why they have that weakened heart. So we make a big push to not only make sure we're treating people well with drugs, but if the heart muscle is already weak, to make sure that those people are protected from a rapid heart rhythm.
But how do people know that sometimes? For example, when I was in the hospital last year getting a defibrillator, there was a woman who came in with viral cardiomyopathy. And she had no idea she had it. She was in her 40s, working at a factory. All of a sudden, she was so sick. She was sick for months before she got to the hospital. Her family finally dragged her in.
Right.
And even the doctors, I mean, my husband and I looked. Actually, my husband came in the room, and he's like, she's got viral cardiomyopathy. And the doctors didn't even know it till they did the heart cath. But people... It's hard to really know, and it's really scary to think just some virus you got could cause that. Isn't it fairly rare?
Well, it's much more rare than coronary artery disease is, certainly. But I think, like Lori mentioned, these symptoms that occur may not be classic chest pain, mm-hmm. but may be exertional fatigue and shortness of breath that occur out of the ordinary. Certainly people who develop a weakened heart muscle, that muscle cannot pump well enough to supply the body's needs. And for people who are vigorously exerting themselves and you know, just getting tired from the fatigue of exertion, that's not a problem. But when there's a clear change in the exercise tolerance and the ability to reach a certain level of exercise, particularly if you get short of breath just walking up and down stairs, it's a good idea to see your internist or general cardiologist. They can perform a test called an echocardiogram, which is non-invasive and uses sound waves and virtually is painless, and can look at how well the heart squeezes and have a better idea if that might be the cause of why you're short of breath.
Is congestive heart failure reversible?
You know, it can be, particularly in the setting of myocarditis. Many people will get through the illness and the heart muscle will get better, but in some people it does not get better, and you have to treat those people with medications. We know that there are dramatic responses to beta blocker therapy and also to ACE inhibition, or the angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor drugs that are out there. Those two forms of drugs have really helped our patients live longer with heart failure. And now we have devices that can resynchronize or help different walls of the muscle that may be kind of contracting at different times, so the heart muscle is not working efficiently. We can implant certain devices that will actually help the heart muscle work in a more coordinated fashion, not necessarily giving them more muscle, but helping what muscles there work better. And many people can have dramatic improvements in their functional ability and improvements in their heart muscle function with those treatments.
Let me ask both of you a prevention question. There's been a lot of publicity recently for some research that suggests that a low-fat diet isn't as beneficial in preventing heart disease as we used to think. And I wondered if you could kind of fill us in on that and see if people have the right impression.
Well, I'll take a stab at it, and I'll let Lori pick up the pieces.
You know what I think it is, and this is going to sound kind of strange, I think it's too much insulin. And I think that people who eat high carbohydrate or high diets, there is a reflex outpouring of insulin that occurs. And insulin is a hormone secreted by the pancreas in our bodies that helps us absorb those calories into the cells. And if you eat a lot of sugar or carbohydrate, then the body tends to want to collect that, because in the old days, our body is uniquely made to store the food that we found so that we can use it when we don't have food around. Unfortunately, we have so much food around here, particularly in the United States, that what happens also with insulin is you tend to crave more food when you have higher levels of insulin. So the low-fat diets may not help, because people are eating so much carbohydrate that they're secreting all this insulin that then makes them want to eat more, and then they start gaining more and more weight, and it can become a real vicious cycle for people.
Lori, do you have any further thoughts?
Well, I have to say I agree. I think that carbohydrate craving is a big issue for people, and it comes out of that cycle of having early satiety and then dropping blood sugar levels and charging ahead at looking for food again because their insulin levels have been high. And I think that everybody wants an easy fix to the dietary question, and there really isn't an easy fix to it. There's a lot of very confusing dietary information out there. People have a difficult time understanding simple things like reading food labels, and then they get confusing information from various sources that tell them one week that they should be eating high protein and another they should be eating high carbohydrate. And I encourage people to eat very balanced diets of the things that they enjoy, but I prefer to push them in the direction of something more Mediterranean-like, where they're eating more complex carbohydrates, they're eating more fish, lower amounts of meat, because I think there's a stress for high protein diets on the body as well. And like anything, moderation and the things that you enjoy, as opposed, and making it a lifestyle change, as opposed to I've got to go on this crash crazy diet, lose a ton of weight, and then not be able to maintain that as a lifestyle change, and before you know it, you've gone back to the way that you always ate and regained the weight that you lost.
Well, I think we're about going to have to wrap it up. We have a ton of questions here that our readers wrote in. I mean, it's obvious that heart disease is a huge concern, so we'd love to have you back another time. But tell us where to find each of you. Where can our listeners go to find you to get more of these questions answered, maybe to learn more about heart disease? Lori, where is your website?
Well, I both blog and answer heart disease questions for WebMD.
And tell us about WebMD very briefly.
WebMD is a patient proactive website that has multiple blogs and also boards where people can go and have their individual questions addressed in regard to any of the disease processes that they may be dealing with. My board is in regard to heart disease and heart failure. Recently, the blogs have evolved out of WebMD as well, and my blog is more informational and just bringing things like the current research or commentary about what's going on in, say, the politics of medicine or funding for research or the interesting things that I'm reading about, for example, that study out of the University of Texas. So that's more of an informational place, but the heart disease board is a place where individuals could certainly come and address a question to me, and I'd be happy to answer it.
Okay, so they just go to WebMD and then type your name in to find you?
Yes. Okay. Yes, there are two headers, one that says, actually it starts out with boards and blogs, and then as you click on that, you go into subheadings that will take them to a list of all the boards, and mine is called Heart Disease and Heart Failure, or there's a separate list of blogs.
Okay, and Dr. West, where do we find you?
Well, I can be found at two places. One can be at www.medtees.com, M-E-D-T-E-E-S.com. That website is actually a site that my wife and I developed that makes patient-related T-shirts for empowering patients.
Yes, I have one. I absolutely love it. Whenever I put that thing on, I get so many questions. It's got the word death on it. Been there, done that, and it's for people with cardiac defibrillators.
Right.
I love it.
Well, we've got about 30 such shirts for defibrillator patients, but we're not limited to heart disease. We cover the gamut between people with cancer disease, cancer, diabetes, lung disease.
So in other words, when people go to the hospital, instead of flowers or candy, you know, they need to bring a T-shirt, right?
Right, absolutely. And it's just a way to kind of open lines of communication, let people talk. I can be reached through that website, at the Contact Us button, or you can reach me at my blog at drwest.blogspot.com.
Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. I think people are going to find this very informative, and we hope we'll have you back sometime.
Oh. Thanks, Glenn.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Helen.
Thanks a lot.
You know, I really appreciate them coming on, but every time we talk about this heart stuff, I start noticing my pulse a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the gist of it is we don't want to scare people with all this information. Just make you a little bit more aware so when something does happen, you take it seriously and get yourself some help.
Well, I wish you'd gotten help when you had your heart attack instead of having people tell you you were suffering from anxiety and giving you Valium and stuff. But hey, it seems like half of America has been having a heart attack over the ports issue, and how's that for a cool segue into our next guest?
Stuart Baker is the Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security. He'll be talking about the Dubai ports deal and telling us what we don't know but should.
Well, we've certainly heard a lot about the whole ports brouhaha. But the coverage has been kind of inconsistent and often not that informative. Can you just sort of summarize what the deal is actually about and what the issues are and what's going on?
I'd be glad to. The basic deal is that the Dubai Ports World Company is buying a British company that operates a number of terminals in six U.S. ports. The terminal is essentially a pier and a crane and a parking lot where you put the containers that you've unloaded from the ships that stop at the pier. So they there are six of these ports where P&O, the company that's being bought, has terminals. When the transaction went through, the acquiring company asked for approval to make this investment in the United States. It's actually only about 10% of the deal. 90% of the deal is outside the United States, but these assets are in the U.S. And the committee that was asked to review that probably reviews 50 to 100 transactions in a year and examines those for their impact on national security and very occasionally will disapprove a deal that probably formally has disapproved one in the last 15 years. As a practical matter, it has discouraged a few dozen.
So there's no involvement in security in this deal at all, which has been reported some places.
No, the terminal operator doesn't do a lot with respect to the security of the port. The security of the port is the responsibility of the Coast Guard, which worries about the port the Customs and Border Patrol agents, our border protection agency that oversees the security of the cargo. And usually there's a port authority, which is state or local government owned, that is in charge of overall security at the port. Terminal operators have some role. They are facilities owners, and they're regulated by the Coast Guard in terms of having a security plan that fits into the overall security plan of the port. And they get audited to see if they're actually maintaining their fences, checking IDs, having good practices with respect to who gets access to their facilities and the like. So they're not completely irrelevant to port security, but this is not a foreign company taking over U.S. ports or taking over port security.
How many Arab companies are involved in port operations around the United States now? This isn't the first deal like that, is it?
It may be the first deal with Arab ownership, but in fact, if you look at terminals operated in the U.S., probably 70 or 80% of them are owned by foreign companies, Danish companies, Singaporean companies, Taiwanese companies. It's an area that U.S. companies have not been strong in really for decades.
Why is that?
You know, I'm not an expert in the economics of ports, but I think these terminal operations have tended to go with companies that have big, vibrant shipping concerns as well. And the U.S. hasn't had a big, vibrant shipping industry for decades. It also was kind of a low-margin business for a long time. I mean, you know, it's not exactly high-tech running the crane out and lifting containers out and dropping them on the parking lot. Recently, there have been there's been a development in the industry of sort of mega ports, kind of the shipping equivalent of hub airports. And there are none in the U.S. for a variety of reasons, but Singapore and Hong Kong and Dubai have turned into these big hubs for container traffic, and increasingly people have figured out ways to increase their margins by using good information technology to keep track of the cargo and to move it more efficiently. So it's become a more profitable business recently, but it's going to be awfully difficult for U.S. companies to break into that business.
I can imagine that you could do a lot to improve security of container traffic with things like tamper-resistant seals and RFID technology and that sort of thing, and tying it into a central database so you can really track these things.
Yeah, that's the future for sure, and we've begun down that path. I mean, it's one of the things that we did after September 11 is push the borders of the U.S. out. The nightmare, of course, is somebody will use a weapon of mass destruction against the U.S., and that the way they'll get it to the target is to put it in the container and just ship it. And we were inspecting for radiological materials in all of our ports when somebody said, well, gee, you know, it isn't really a victory if we find a WMD and keep it from going off on the other side of the free trade zone boundary here in Newark or in some other port. So we began pressing other countries to let us do our radiological inspections overseas. And in fact, Dubai was the first Middle East port to say, yeah, we'd like to do that. We'll help you set up a screening system here in Dubai so that you don't have to worry that there's something in the container before it gets to the U.S. And the way we do that is exactly as you would think. We get a lot of information before the product is put on the ship about what's supposed to be in it, who's shipping it, what his history is, where the container's been, a variety of information that allows us to look for anomalies, look for something that seems a little funny, look at whether the party that's stuffing the container or handling it is a party that has signed up to some of our best security practices so that we have some confidence that things can't be sneaked into the container. All of that kind of goes into our choices about what containers we're going to X-ray and inspect.
We talked to Jim Dunnigan and Austin Bay from Strategy Page here a while back, and Dunnigan was fairly confident about the ability to spot nuclear weapons, at least in containers, if they're being imported. Is that right? Do you think there's a pretty good chance of spotting that sort of thing?
It's pretty good. I don't want to say exactly how good. One of the things we have going for us here is if you're a terrorist organization and you've got a nuclear weapon, it's kind of a wrenching thing to give it up and put it in a container and hope that it won't get caught. So I'd like to have them have the maximum uncertainty about that I can.
Of course, in a less comforting thing, what Dunnigan said was the most likely way to deliver a nuclear device would probably be via a commercial airliner flown from Africa or somewhere else rather than a shipping container. And what do we have to deal with that?
Yeah, this is one of the problems. There are a lot of ways that people could, if they got a hold of a nuclear weapon, deliver it to the United States. And we're never going to, if we want to be a trading nation, we're not going to be able to inspect everything before it comes in. So the trick is to ask yourself, what are the most likely scenarios and how have you protected against them? We do have some protections on air cargo as well. So it's not that we are completely without resources, but I actually agree with him that we've probably done our best and most effective job planning for and protecting against the use of containers for that delivery.
Of course, they could always just disguise it as a bale of marijuana. Those seem to get in fine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, with luckily, the dogs would find it, and eventually we'd get to the bottom of it.
Well, I imagine it's been quite the stressful and eventful couple of weeks for you dealing with this, and you've done congressional testimony and so on. What's your sense of how this is playing out politically, and sort of who's taking different positions on this? I mean, I know that sort of the free traders and the economists and stuff are all saying that concern over this is absurd. On the other hand, there's a lot of concern among people. In some sense, I think it's almost a proxy for people's general discomfort about the security of the borders. And maybe you don't want to talk about this as an administration official, but a sense that the Bush administration has actually been a bit wimpy dealing with things like the cartoon protests and stuff like that. So the people just are beginning to doubt the backbone on these kind of issues.
Well, there's obviously a certain delight if you're a Democrat to find an issue where you can be to the right of the Bush administration on national security issues, and that's understandable. I think from the point of view of people who've always supported the administration, this is pretty troubling. And I sort of agree with you that the cartoon thing has provoked a reaction that we're not sure how to measure. That I'm not so sure about the reaction, as that I think a lot of people looked at that and said, well, gee, you know, people who would riot and kill and burn embassies over a cartoon are people we're just not ever going to completely understand or be able to sit down and work out things on a practical level the way Americans tend to believe politics and diplomacy should be. That seems like such an overreaction to us, that the idea that we're making progress as Americans, kind of finding a common ground with the Arab world, really took a big hit in that controversy.
Yeah, I think that people see that as a psychological warfare operation aimed at the Muslim world, but I'm actually not sure that it wasn't just as much a psychological warfare operation aimed at the rest of the world.
No, I understand the notion that this is about saying, you know, you have got to live by our rules to a degree, or you'll pay the price. I think it's just as easy to understand what's going on in that part of the world, and I'm not a diplomat, as a civil war inside Islam about how to relate to the West, you know, we're to a degree caught in it, and people are defining themselves by their relationship to the West. In an odd way, it's like Russia's reaction to the West. They're of it and not of it, and the temptation is always to define yourself as completely different or very much the same as the West, and I think we're seeing the same kind of transition in Islam.
No, I think you're right. I was suggesting that the cartoon wars actually are designed to alienate the West and thus change the position of the pro-Western Muslim community by having them be rejected, essentially.
Yeah, so to say, you know, you're not truly Muslim if you are willing to tolerate the values like freedom of speech, because that leads to cartoons like this.
And to get Westerners to say, you know, all you Muslims look alike to us. We don't want to have anything to do with any of you.
Well, and I think that's a worry in this Dubai ports deal. There's been a lot of focus on ways in which Dubai and the United Arab Emirates haven't lived up to the standards that we'd expect of a Midwestern congressman, and they haven't. They've done things that we don't like, some things we really don't like, but that's true of France and Germany and even Britain. There's no one who's going to act exactly the way we do, and if you're asking yourself who are our most likely friends in the Arab world, UAE is pretty close to as good as it gets, the overreaction to this is going to be harmful. I think the U.S. Navy has said that of all the ports they visit outside the United States, they have more visits to Dubai than any other port. They're very dependent on that deep water port, and the country's been very hospitable to then turn around and say, you know, you just look alike to us, is a bit of a problem.
What's your response to the complaint that some critics of the deal have that, you know, Dubai may be an ally and we don't want to irritate them unnecessarily, but on the other hand, it's just a lot easier for terrorists to infiltrate somebody in an operation that's owned by an Arab company?
I wouldn't dismiss that idea. I think you have to recognize that you're more likely walking down the streets of an Arab country to find people who willingly say, yes, I hate Americans, I'd like to see them die. And so you have to worry, will there be employees? I'm less concerned that the company is going to be by itself a vector for terrorism, but you have to worry about employees. A couple of thoughts on that. This is not the only country where there are people who don't like the United States or who would tolerate terrorism against the United States. After all, Richard Reid was a Brit, and he wanted to blow up a airliner full of Americans. So you could certainly get that reaction from employees from elsewhere. And the other thing that I think is that should influence that decision is the UAE is not really a net exporter of a lot of management. Probably only 10 or 15% of Dubai Port World's operations in Dubai are run by people from the United Arab Emirates. So they import a lot of labor, as many Gulf countries do. So the idea that they would export a lot of employees to the United States as a business matter is, I think, a little unlikely. But one of the things we did as part of this deal is, for the first time ever, we negotiated a set of assurances with a ports company that has the net effect of requiring them to give us, if we ask for it, and we will, all of the names of their permanent employees so that we can run background checks on everybody who works in a U.S. terminal for this company. So, you know, it's not that you can completely dismiss it, but I think we've built in some protections, actually more protections in this deal than we have with other terminals. All of this is risk management. I think we've done a fair amount to manage the risk. We'll be taking another look at all of that in the investigation that is just beginning. But I think people have not perhaps appreciated how much we've already done.
Well, we're almost out of time, but since here in the blogosphere we like to think out of the box, I want to bring some suggestions on port security from Frank J. Fleming, who blogs at imow.us, and just get your reaction as a professional homeland security person. I'm just going to read them one at a time and take a little reaction. First, there's this one. Remember, ports involve delivery with ships. So if some other vehicle than a ship comes into your port, treat it with suspicion. Is that part of the program?
Absolutely. We'll be watching out for, Segways delivering large boxes.
Well, that's good, because the next one is about boxes. He says, just because someone went through all the trouble of painting "not WMDs" on a crate doesn't mean it's true. You might want to consider inspecting that one. Have you passed that advice out to the troops?
We absolutely will be doing that.
No, that's good. I don't want you to give away all the big secrets, but I thought that was an important one.
Yep.
Now this is more personnel-oriented. Muslim extremists hate cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad, so put an unflattering comic about Muhammad on your door. If anyone tries to kill you over it, treat that person with suspicion.
Well, you're going to have trouble finding a clipping from an American newspaper to cut out.
Okay, one more. Terrorists want to smuggle a nuclear bomb into America, so if you find a nuclear bomb in one of your inspections, make sure it's on the manifest.
That's right. The duty is very high on this.
Well, I hope you'll share these important pieces of advice with the people in charge, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
All right. Glad to talk to both of you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
I wonder what tips Frank J. would have for heart surgeons.
You know, I think it's best we keep Frank J. away from sharp objects, electricity, or powerful medications.
And blenders.
That's my territory. Thank you very much. Well, we hope you enjoyed this podcast, our 12th in a row. You can stay tuned for further episodes by checking our websites, instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com. Or you can subscribe via iTunes, which we like. In the meantime, find some fun stuff on the internet until we're back.
Talk to you next time.